thank you to Burning Books, and thank you to y'all for coming out. Feels really good to feel people want to hear about this story. You know, my family is a very controversial group of people. My job is to try to tell the story of what happened so that we're still seeking justice. Some of our people are still in prison, and we're still trying to figure out how to free our people, you know. And even the people that are home are not even free, you know. So we're still trying to figure that out. But I wanted to read something from my book to try to give you kind of a glimpse of the history that I've been living with and the Philadelphia community and many of our people that know the story somewhat. But this book is very much so about the organization and my perspective from it. Chapter 1, the bombing. On Mother's Day in 1985, the Philadelphia Police Department waged war on my family, the MOVE organization. It is the darkest day in modern Philadelphia history. The police dropped a bomb on our home, killing 5 of my MOVE brothers and sisters and 6 of my MOVE aunties and uncles, and destroying 61 houses. More than 250 of our neighbors were left homeless. I still remember the black cloud of smoke from the fire above my West Philly block as it stretched across to New Jersey on one side and Delaware on the other. "Evacuate!" echoed throughout the block. More than 500 uniformed officers wrapped in riot gear from head to toe stormed 6221 Osage Avenue around 6:25 a.m., pounding on doors, spewing commands, and manhandling residents. "Evacuate!" Our neighbors, startled with sleep still in their eyes, awoke to, "Leave now, and you must evacuate immediately." Confused residents quickly rushed out of their homes, holding all they could carry. Tow trucks were removing cars, and children scampered and scattered around the cops. Some homeowners and renters paused to demand answers. "What's happening? Evacuate to where? Where are we supposed to go?" "Shut the f*** up and evacuate," cops spat back. By 7:30 a.m., the PPD, the Philadelphia Police Department, had blockaded the community, allowing newly crowned Police Commissioner Gregor Sambor, a pale, blockheaded, ex-military vet, to take center stage with his bullhorn. He screamed, "Attention, MOVE. This is not a warning. This is America." People nearby retreated in fear. "You must abide by the laws of the American government," he said. Me and my big sister, Wit, watched the scene unfold from my grandma Laverne's house on 39th and Reno Streets, which is about 4.5 miles away from the Osage Avenue house that was under siege. But at this moment, just like every other moment, Osage Avenue was precisely where my heart and thoughts resided. It was where Delisha, Tommaso, Little Phil, Tree, Netta, Birdie, and all the other MOVE kids and I would run and hug and hide and fight and cry and make up and fight some more. It's where we played and laughed till our stomachs ached and where we learned to eat and love hard. I wasn't living at Osage Avenue at the time, but it was just as part of me as much as I was a part of it. "What are those people doing?" I asked a room full of frantic adults who'd gathered in Laverne's living room. "Why are they towing the cars? What's happening? I'm scared." "Hush, Keita, hush," Laverne said. Laverne held her finger close to her mouth as she drank in the news story. "I'm as confused as you are," she said. She didn't say it, but I could tell she was just as scared too. The sun typically gets an early start in May, yet it was very dark out. The street lights clashed with the police lights on our television screen, causing an identical glare on every local news channel, where the local reporters covering the story all wore the same look of disbelief on their faces. We watched as the police sealed Osage Avenue on both ends with their trucks, paddy wagons, and tanks, as if our residential neighborhood was a foreign nation they were invading. Those tanks were full of cops hopping out and dashing in every direction across our television screen. We saw cops climbing onto the roof with rifles on their backs, cops tucked off to the side with their pistols drawn, cops who didn't want to be caught on camera waving off reporters, cops in huddles, angry cops, laughing cops, and sadly, cops with their machine guns and pistols trained on Osage Avenue at every angle. With teary eyes, Laverne grabbed her things and rushed toward the front door. "Where are you going?" I asked. "Osage," she said. She didn't look back. The siege on Osage Avenue wasn't the first confrontation between MOVE and the Philadelphia Police Department. 7 years earlier, in 1978, they attempted to evict MOVE from their original headquarters located in Powhatan Village section of West Philly. When MOVE refused to submit to the Philadelphia Police Department's demands, police called in the fire department to flush them out. Firefighters shot four high-pressure water hoses at MOVE's house. Those hoses aren't supposed to be sprayed anywhere near people, which was excellent for the Philadelphia police because they didn't see MOVE members as people worth caring about. MOVE had been under attack by Philly police for years. And to understand why those attacks happened, you have to understand who my great uncle John Africa was. So, John Africa, my great uncle, he started the organization with the simple mission to protect life, people, animals, and the environment. And having that mission raised a lot of concerns, it raised a lot of eyebrows. John Africa would have members of the organization go to the circus. Barnum and Bailey Ringley Brothers, I think they've taken the animal portion of their circus out within the last few years, but back then, they had tigers jumping through rings of fire, they had elephants balancing on balls, they had bear, they had all this different type of animal and animal displays, and John Africa would have MOVE members go to the circus and protest, and on the signs they read, "Barnum and Bailey Ringling Brothers Sadism." And it would say, you know, he would say, tigers weren't made to jump through rings of fire, and if you think it's okay for tigers to be forced and beaten and electrocuted and intimidated and to jump in through rings of fire, if you think that's okay, why don't you make your kids do it? Why don't you jump through that ring of fire? You know, he was just really passionate about his belief that animals should be free. And so that raised a lot of issues because the circus brought a lot of money in the city of Philadelphia. Anybody in here ever heard of Frank Rizzo? Frank Rizzo was the most brutal, racist mayor, police commissioner the city, at least, and probably the country has ever seen. When MOVE would go protest at the circus, Frank Rizzo would have the police come out there to break up the demonstration. And MOVE, they were not going to just back down just because he said, "You got to move." And they didn't care that it was the police saying, "You got to move." They would say things like, "We got the right to be here. We ain't breaking any laws." And, you know, and they would stay. And then that would turn into members getting arrested and put in jail for, I mean, MOVE members got the kind of charges that MOVE members would get for some of the things that they did. Oh, man, in many cases, the punishment really didn't fit the crime. Chuck Africa was a maybe 13, 14-year-old kid at the time. He would protest, and when he got arrested, they would put him in jail for truancy. You hook your school to go to a protest, so they put him in jail for 10 days. That led to more protests. MOVE would go to the Board of Education and talk about how the kids are not being educated properly, and they would protest that. They would protest the Philadelphia Zoo. They protest police brutality. Anything that they thought was wrong, they would protest. I know locks are very popular now, but in 1972, I can assure you they were not. A lot of people can remember the first time they saw somebody with locks. That's how, you know, kind of, you know, unpopular it was. But MOVE had locks, and people didn't really understand it. They didn't really know where they came from, or they never saw it before, so how do you grow them? You know, and they, MOVE got this kind of reputation and, like, stigma for being dirty, because people thought of the hair as dirty, uncombed, unkept. So MOVE was fighting a couple of battles. The initial battles that gave them the idea, which was protest against injustice, then they had to fight this other battle of the police. Now they got to fight this other battle of the news media and slander. And eventually it got to a thing where MOVE members would protest and the disruption was so common and so constant that the Rizzo administration decided we want to get them off the street and we want to do it permanently. And, you know, when MOVE members heard about that, they started really protesting heavy. And then Rhonda Africa was 8 months pregnant. And she was protesting at City Hall against some of the judges that had jailed people with extreme length of time for their offense or alleged offense. 8 months pregnant, and the police attacked the demonstration, and they attacked her, and they beat her so bad that her baby came a month early and was born with black and blue bruises all over his body and stillborn. And so MOVE members was like, you know, we're not doing this. So they took a stand. They built a platform around their house. They call it MOVE headquarters now, but back then it was just their house. But they built the platform around it, and they came out on May 20th, 1977, and they came out there armed, and they made a statement. Delbert Africa read a statement. He said, no more will we allow or accept the beating of MOVE people without a like response. If the police come in here and attacking our people, we will defend ourselves. If they come at us with fists, we'll fight them with fists. If they come at us with clubs, we will fight them with clubs. If they come in here shooting the men, the women, and at our kids, we will shoot back in defense of our lives. That led to a standoff. The Rizzo administration put up a blockade around the community to keep people out and to keep MOVE in. Anybody leave the platform, they get arrested. And that standoff lasted for about a year. When the barricade was up and they were trying to figure out some kind of negotiations, what do MOVE want to shut this thing down, and what do they want from the city? They were going back and forth. MOVE was saying things like, we want to free our people from prison. We want y'all to leave us alone. Stop the abuse of the MOVE organization and the way Rizzo is treating people. Stop the brutality and whatnot. They kind of came to a decision, but kind of didn't. It led to, I don't know what to call it. It was a shootout, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, but it was probably, at that time, the worst shootout in Philadelphia history. It only lasted for 4 minutes, but it was a lot of gunfire. 500 Philadelphia police went to MOVE's house with eviction notices because they said MOVE had housing code violations, they broke an agreement, and whatever, whatever. But the main reason for being there was they said MOVE had housing code violations. Shot up the house. They brought fire hoses. Have you ever seen the way those hoses they use? Have you ever seen how powerful they are? Next to fighting a fire in a building, you really kind of can't really get a good understanding of how powerful those things are. But you remember the 60s when Dr. King was marching and the fire department would come and shoot those water cannons at people and it would be knocking them and the people would be flipping down the street? They got much more powerful by 1978. I don't even know why the fire department was there. There was no fire. It's like the fire department is like firefighters. They're like police with fire hoses. They came and they went in MOVE's house. They took a chainsaw and cut a hole in the floor because they knew that MOVE members were in the basement of the house. And they took the fire hose and they trained it on the people that was in the house. My mother, by then, she had a 2-year-old baby and she was 8 months pregnant with me. And there was other pregnant women in the house too. And they knew it. Then when that one didn't drive them out or kill them, they brought two more. They had two more hoses trained on MOVE's house. Those hoses can shoot 10 stories straight up in the air. 10 stories. Firefighters are trained to never use them on buildings that they know people are inside of because of the destabilizing of the structure and can cause a collapse. And they had three of those hoses on MOVE's house. Shot tear gas. Anybody in here ever been hit with tear gas before? Yep. Tear gas hurts. It burns. It gets in your throat. It sticks to your clothes. It's painful. I don't recommend tear gas filling up a house that people are inside of, especially pregnant women. And then they started shooting. And they shot so many rounds of ammunition, the people couldn't see their hand in front of their face, but they could see the bullets whizzing past them. And they could hear the babies crying. Later, the police admitted to shooting. They couldn't see either. They admitted to shooting in the corners where they could hear the babies crying. MOVE members felt their way up the steps out of the basement and found their way outside. And when they did, they were immediately arrested by the waiting police officers. Delbert Africa was crawling out the side of the house. And as he's crawling out the side, four cops with their weapons pointed at him, bring it over here. And what happened next? There's a documentary that I worked with a filmmaker by the name of Tommy Oliver that's on HBO Max that shows what happened when Delbert Africa came out of that basement. One cop took a steel helmet and swung it so hard and smacked Delbert in the head with it and cracked his skull. The other one took the butt of his rifle and swung it and hit Delbert in the face and broke his jaw. They knocked him to the ground and started, airborne, jumping on his head, kicking him in the face, kicking him in the groin. They kicked him so hard, they lifted him up off the ground. And that was after he was shot in the chest with a shotgun. And then they lied and said it didn't happen. We never beat him. We never did anything. But fortunately, like Jason, somebody had it on video. All the MOVE members were taken to jail. And while they were in jail, according to my mother, this is what she told me, she said, while we were in jail, getting all of the wet clothes off of us and the tear gas clothes off of us, they told us that we're going to jail for life because a cop got killed. So this was my mother's introduction to a cop getting killed. But that's what they say. James Ramp was 53 years old, a desk cop generally, but that day he wanted to be there. And while all of that shooting was happening, he was shot and killed. And of course, the police blamed it on MOVE. The news that had been slandering MOVE with all of this, they're crazy. They don't take baths. They eat raw food. Raw food is a popular thing now. Raw food restaurants, you can go across the country and get vegan options and get raw food and all of this different stuff. And then in the 70s, nobody was eating raw food. MOVE was a very controversial organization, even in the organization. Like, everybody that were members of the organization didn't like the way MOVE lived. Because just as it was new to the world, it was also new to the members. They had never seen locks before. My father first saw John Africa walking around with some dreadlocks. He was like, yeah, I'm not joining that. He was a Marine. And you know, they clean cut, you know, close shaven. But what it was is my mom is John Africa's niece, and she was a member to support her uncle. And my dad was in love with my mom. So that's how he ended up being involved and a part of it. But now it's 1978. They got arrested. They're in jail with, they don't know what the sentence is going to be. All they know is the city, the system, the government, the judges are against them from the start. How many people in here remember the O.J. Simpson trial? Okay, so in Philly, they were covering the story, the O.J. case, heavily, right? So anything happened, usually the paper come out the next day. If there's a fire that happens that burns down an old warehouse, you'll read about it in the paper the following day. In the O.J. case, remember that? Papers were coming out twice a day. That's what it was like with MOVE. When MOVE went to jail, later that day, there were news reports of it. I mean, newspapers of it. That the following day was the follow-up to those earlier ones. And on the front page, before MOVE was even dry from the water that they were soaked with, the paper read, oh my God, they shot a cop. The judge in MOVE's case, the judge, Judge Edwin Malmet, before discovery, before they decided what was going to happen with MOVE in the trial, before the trial began, the judge had a meeting with all of MOVE's public defenders and told them, the men are going to prison. They're going upstate, there's no doubt about it. We might be able to work out something for the women, but the men are going upstate. All of that stuff that they say about innocent until proven guilty, that didn't apply when it came to MOVE. True to his words, 3 years, the longest trial in American history, ended with 9 MOVE members convicted for 30 to 100 years for the accusation of one cop death. Judge even admitted that he didn't even know who killed the cop. But you said you're a family, you all were together, and so I will oblige you as a family, whatever, whatever, you're going to jail, all, prison, 100 years each. My parents, the other MOVE members that were still on the street, it was Mo Africa, John Africa, Carlos, Sue, a bunch of other MOVE members were still out. And they began to like protest this sentence. The house that MOVE was evicted from, that was attacked, the police tore that down. By the end of the day, while the newspapers were coming out, they were rolling over the property with the bulldozer, destroyed their entire property. No evidence left. They were cutting the trees down, any bullets that might have been fired that they don't want people to investigate. They cut the trees down, put them in a chipper. No evidence, no evidence, none. So MOVE went to a house on Osage Avenue. And on Osage Avenue, they were protesting heavily. They were protesting so heavy to free the people. They strapped the bullhorn to the front of the house. They just made so much noise. And MOVE members, you know, in the 70s, you're coming off the heels of the death, the assassination of Dr. King and the assassination of Malcolm X. It was just a few short years earlier. And the way they presented themselves, they were in suits and ties. And they spoke a certain way, and they carried themselves a certain way. MOVE was different. MOVE was kind of like the Black Panther Party, but even their language, oh my God, I'm thinking about some of the things they would say. Their language was so extreme and like, mother this and mother that and you and this mother, I don't give a. It is just like all of this, like people that, you know, revolutionaries, they didn't really talk like that. They might talk like that privately, but not on a stage, not publicly like that. And then they would say things to the cops. The cops, I know the cops wanted to kill them. Just not even because of racism, not even because of law and order, just because they just wanted to say, shut the f*** up. MOVE members would say, like if there's two cops right here, right? So you got one black cop and one white cop, right? They would say, they would be on the bullhorn and they would say, why y'all sitting together? Y'all know y'all don't like each other. This black man is going home to eat some chitlins. You don't like the smell of chitlins. And this white man is going home to eat some Brussels sprouts. You don't like Brussels sprouts. You don't even eat vegetables. Y'all don't like each other, you know it. Both of y'all need to just kill each other right now. Like, they would just say stuff. And then when he get home, he gonna be trying to call your wife. And your wife like him. Did you know that? And they would just, what are you talking about? Like, shut up. And then it got like, you know, once they was at Osage Avenue, it turned into like a threatening thing. Like, yo, y'all gonna let our people go. The next time any of y'all cops come down this street, we're gonna kill y'all since y'all took our people. You put our people in jail, we ain't got nothing to lose. We'll kill you. And it escalated. And Osage Avenue is a residential neighborhood. Y'all don't have row houses up here, right? Well, in Philly, we have row houses. That's 20 houses connected to each other. Will Smith said, that means if we got roaches, y'all got roaches. They're all connected. You can hear what's happening in each other's houses. So MOVE is protesting and they're on their bullhorn and every house connected to their row can hear them. And then across the street, there's another set of houses. So, you know, people were complaining and they said, we don't care that you complain. If you don't like what we're doing, go take it to City Hall and complain to them. Because they're the people that put our people in prison. If you tell them to free our people, if they free our people, we'll stop talking. Didn't happen. The next part of this whole thing is probably the most, I don't even know, this is another one, I don't have a word for it. It's never happened in American history. I don't think you can arrest people for disturbing or for yelling at somebody. I don't think you can. But some of them had warrants on them for like misdemeanors. You know, maybe somebody didn't pay a traffic ticket or so. It was simple stuff. But the city's response to MOVE and their protest and their yelling and their threats was to drop a bomb on them. They literally went to the state of Pennsylvania and got a state helicopter They brought in this managing director who was a brigadier general in the military, got some weapons, and then they went in this remote area of Northeast Philadelphia, and they started building replicas of our house and practicing blowing them up with C4. And then a year later, they came to our house, flew a helicopter over it, and dropped 4 pounds of C4. That chapter I read, that's real. They, attention move, this is America, you must abide by the laws of the American government. And then they started with the water cannons and the smoke, the smoke grenades and the tear gas. And moved, members were in the house and they went down into the basement of the house, wrapped their heads in wet towels to try to breathe. And then they started shooting. I talked to some of the police officers that were there that day. And I asked them, why did y'all start shooting? And he said, we didn't know if it was us shooting or if it was MOVE shooting. And I said, well, it's been 40 years. What do you know now? He said, I know that when I heard the gunshots, I thought it was MOVE. But some of the blasts, he said, we drilled holes in from the neighbors' houses and we dropped C4, small blocks of C4 from there. And the blasts, the pops, sounded like gunfire. So we opened fire. Before they dropped the bomb, the C4 that they used to listen blew the front of MOVE's house into the street. And the gunfire, it wasn't like 7 years earlier where they shot a few hundred rounds of ammunition. According to the police's calculation, they fired over 10,000 rounds of ammunition. And the weapons they used, M16, M14, M1, 12-gauge shotgun, armor-piercing anti-tank gun, 50 caliber machine gun. You know what happens when gas is collected in a space? The gas, this is just similar to what happened with the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. When the gas is trapped and there's no escape, there's no ventilation for it, it can erupt. The bomb mixed with the tear gas ignited a fire. And the fire department that had been there earlier blasting water on the house thought that was the time for them to turn the water off. The fire burned and burned. And at a certain point, the police commissioner thought it was a good idea to use the fire as a weapon to drive, force people out of the burning house. The fire burned so hot, it reached the temperature that melts steel. And the row of blocks that MOVE was in was across the street from the other row of houses that were not connected, but the intense heat sparked a fire across the street too. MOVE members were trying to find their way out of the basement. And every time they tried to escape, they were met with police gunfire. And when they finally did get out of the house, they were shot. The fire burned down 61 homes. And while the fire was still burning, to cover up the fact that the people were shot, the police picked up their bodies and threw them back in the fire. When the smoke cleared, finally the fire department turned the water on. 11 MOVE members, including 5 children, were dead. And the two survivors, 13-year-old Birdie and the lone adult survivor, Ramona Africa. Ramona was arrested and taken to jail. And ironically, her charges were riot and arson. She was sentenced to 7 years in prison. I remember watching it on TV. I remember being so confused. Nobody gave me any explanation. I think they were, you know, when you're 20, 20 something years old, I don't really know what's going on. I see what's happening, but I don't know what's really happening. 7 years later, Ramona is scheduled to be released from prison. I haven't spoken to Ramona in a long time. Internal conflicts created this weird thing, but we haven't spoken in a long time. But when she came home, I was 13 years old. I was a bad kid. My parents were in prison. I give myself a pass. But if I saw me come in at this age, I probably wouldn't let me date my daughter. I'll tell you about my grandma, right? So my grandmother was one of those, she was born in the 30s, and she definitely believed in like capital punishment in the house. And you know, I was the kind of person, you know how what they say, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission? That was me. Grandma, can I go? I ain't asking. I might have asked her once or twice. Grandma, can I go play so-and-so with my friends? No. Can I go to New York with my friends? No, you can't go to. You can't just go to New York. How they get into New York? They get on a bus. No, you're 13 years old. You can't go to New York with your friends on no bus. Any parents going? No. I wouldn't even know. But I would be like, all right, well, cool. So I'm not going to ask her no more. But when I got home, Grandma, the belt would be ready. She had that thing ready. And one day, I did something, and Grandma was tired of me. you ever see the old fight with like Joe Louis and, or Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier? They just be punching each other, just beating each other up. Well, I was like one of them, just not throwing any punches, just getting my beat. And I was, and Grandma, but I'm 13 though, so this you're not just gonna be beating me up. So I grabbed her arms, and that was, oh, you see what I'm saying? That's what she said. Mm-mm. She snatched her arms away. You want to fight? I said, no, I don't want to fight. And then she tore me up. So I'm sitting there. I'm all messed up. I'm more humiliated than anything, but I'm crying. And as I was sitting there wiping my tears, my mom called from prison. And my grandma said, this boy is, he's getting too old. I can't beat him. I can't just keep doing this to him. And she says, he needs some principal. And I get on the phone with my mom. I say, Mom, when Mona come home, I say, you can ask her to come and get me? And, you know, because Move had his problems, but they were principal, you know, they were. You know, they lived a certain way. It was rugged. It was exercise. It was a lot of, you know, discipline, things like that, like kind of militaristic in a sense. So I'm thinking to myself, Mona ain't got time for me. But she came home on May 13th, 1992. On May 14th at 8:00 in the morning, she was knocking on the door. Are you ready? And I wasn't ready for her to take me anywhere or for what I was about to go through. But I got in the car with her and she took me to the move house. And I hadn't been in move since then, since the 80s, since that bombing happened, the internal conflicts with move, with each other, I hadn't seen each other, people. I hadn't been around people. But move has a distinct smell. It has from all that raw food in the house, the pineapples and the mangoes and a sweet potato, all that stuff has a smell, and collected, it has a distinct smell. So when I was going out, I remembered that smell. I remembered the vibration, and I remembered the way the kids were with each other, and I just felt like I was home. And then Ramona started giving me all of this information about my family, and she wasn't a blood member, but she was married to my Uncle Chuck, and she was like, she had been in the organization for a while, she was telling me all this stuff about my family and my mother, and I inherited this stuff before. She's like, you were born in jail. I was like, I wasn't born in jail. She's like, yeah, you was born in jail. I said, no, I wasn't. Don't tell people that. I went, Grandma, was I born in jail? You was born in jail. I was. She laughed a little bit, like you didn't know that? Like, well, how would I know that? articles about it and all of this stuff. And then we in a space. It was like Leslie was talking about earlier. We was at this place, and it was like 1,000 people at this college, and Ramona's on the stage, and she was like, this brother has never been with his mother all his life, and he was born in the jail cell. And I'm like, yo, don't tell people that. She looked at me. She was on the stage. She looked at me. I don't know what she was thinking, but when it was over, she came over to me and she said, you seem like you don't like me saying you was born in jail. I said, I don't. Why would anybody like that? That's embarrassing. And she said, you shouldn't be embarrassed by that. Do you know how strong your mother had to be to have you in a jail cell and to keep you secret and to make sure that she protected you from the guards that might try to kill you? You know how strong your mother had to be? She said, you shouldn't be embarrassed by that. You should be proud of that. I wasn't sold on it, but I understood it. When Ramona came home, you know, she spoke a lot about, you know, MOVE history. And one thing she started talking about that I knew the internal life of MOVE. I didn't know the external part. I've been to court cases and seen MOVE members in court. I was a kid in this group. But then Ramona started talking about this other person that wasn't a MOVE member, but his name was like kind of popular in the movement. He was a Black Panther, a member of the Black Panther Party when he was like 14 years old. He was the Lieutenant of Information. And his name was Mumia Abu-Jamal. And I was like, who is that? And she was like, that's another case where a cop got killed and they blamed it on him. And I'm like, what's up with him? And she's like, well, you know, there's a lot of information. There's a lot to show that he didn't do it. There's all his evidence. And he got railroaded in court. So it's him, and then it's the MOVE members, and my parents, all these people. And so just hearing all of these things about these injustices, it just kind of made me feel like I wanted to be a part of trying to get these people out of jail too. So Ramona traveled around the country. I traveled around the country with her, trying to just make people aware of what happened so that we could get the people out of prison. And the city wouldn't budge. They wouldn't budge. I mean, 10 years after the people were put in prison, 20 years. Philadelphia is a city, and I imagine it's just like any other big city for the most part in terms of its politics. Some of the politicians, some of the police officers that were there on August 8th when these people got arrested publicly said, in court, yeah, and MOVE didn't do that. And their claim just fell on deaf ears. Nobody, the judge himself who sentenced them said he didn't know who did it. But it didn't mean anything. 1985, when the bomb was dropped, there was a Black mayor at the time. His name was Wilson Good. He said he didn't believe that the MOVE members killed the cop. He believed that the cop was killed by friendly fire. But that didn't mean that they was going to free the people. They didn't. So 10 years after the bombing, 20 years after the bombing, we're talking 30 years later after the bombing. The bombing was 7 years after their arrest, and they're still in prison with no hope of getting out. By 2018, they had been denied parole for 10 years, even though they had, stellar prison records. Every guard, every prison official supported their release, and they were still being denied. And then, after all that traveling around with Ramona, Ramona couldn't travel anymore. She got sick. She had a stroke, and then she had cancer, and then she diabetes, all of these different medical and health issues. She told me, she said, look, I can't do this anymore. You had to take the lead. For years, I had been telling Mona that I thought we should be doing things differently. For years, I had been explaining to her that I felt like the people we were talking to were the same old people that had been denying us for years. And I thought that we should try to talk to other people and other officials. And at the time, there was a new district attorney in Philadelphia named Larry Krasner. and I was thinking about talking to him. And I really couldn't get any respect within the organization. The people, the older people, they were just so adamant about doing things the way they were doing things, and they were not willing to change anything. And I fought with them, and I argued with them, and I challenged them, and they were not willing to change. But when Ramona got sick and she said, "It's in your hands now," I told her that day when she told me, "It's in your hands," I told her, I said, "I'm not going to do it the way y'all did it, because I don't think that worked." She said, "You got enough principle. You've been around long enough. I trust you." I said, "My girl." First thing I did was make phone calls to everybody that ever supported MOVE. I'm talking about anybody, even the people that we didn't like anymore. I mean, there were people that, I'm talking politicians that were just nasty to MOVE, but they knew the case. I'd just call them. All of that, going to conferences, we would be going to these conferences. I was 13-year-olds not supposed to be going to conferences. Do you know what happens with 13-year-olds when we go to the conference? Oh, man. I'm in law offices with lawyers, and they saying these words with 17 letters in them. And I'm like, oh, man, where's my Nintendo? And I was just like, Mona, the people don't want to, this is boring. Can we do something? That's why I started rapping. And putting out me, I said, I'm going to do some rap. I had a rap called Just Because It's Legal Don't Make It Right. And I would, you know, because I want to give people information, but I want them to be able to accept it. For young people, we want to be entertained as we do this. So I said, look, we're going to have to shake things up. So I started calling all these people. I started trying to set up events to try to get them involved, get them to set up events, to raise funds, all this different stuff. And then something happened that kind of changed the trajectory. Wilson Good, the mayor who was at the helm when the bomb was dropped, was being honored with his very own street sign. And the people in Philadelphia wasn't having it. They did it, they announced it, or they didn't announce it. They wrote it in the paper and kind of put it in there. And people, it kind of slipped through the cracks. Then they went over, they did the whole thing, they put it in, and then they went on vacation. When people found out about it, though, I mean, they were, the city was about to be on fire again. They said, the minute that sign go on that pole, we're going to climb up the pole and bring that sign down and throw it through his window. We're going to drag him out of his house and do to him what his people did to our people. The city was just ready to, I'm in free the people mode. I get where they're coming from, but for me, I really can't see that. I can see the goal. So I hear what they're saying, I see what they're saying, but in my mind, how can we turn this negative into a positive? So while people were building the cross for Wilson Good, I sat back and said, let me see how this is going to play out. And then Wilson Good got on the radio and he said, I'm sorry for what happened. I grieve for the people. I wish I could take it back. He said all of these apologetic things. And then he said, and I'm committed to support and help the MOVE organization for the rest of my life. Now, I've done a lot of hard things in my life. Things that I had no control over, things that were not my decisions. Just being born and not having my parents was its own level of toughness. It's not easy not having your parents and being a community kid and you're living with this person for a few weeks and then that person for a little while, and you're just kind of like not really, you don't belong to anyone. You just, that has its own challenges. These confrontations, the two I specifically told y'all about were two, but there were a lot of other ones, smaller ones, where the police raided our house and took the kids and put us in an abusive orphanage. All this, I've had my fair share of pain and dealing with hard things. But the hardest thing I ever had to do was make the phone call to the person that dropped the bomb. That's what I had to do. The MOVE people had been in prison for 40 years. By then, Merle died in 1998, Phil died in 2015, and my father was on his way. But my father was sick, and at that point, it was kind of like a selfish thing a little bit. I needed to be able to sleep at night. There was no way this man, my father, who did the best he could to raise me from prison, he would give me his left leg and his right arm. And I couldn't watch my dad die in prison. It was so conflicting. But I made that call. And he said, "This is Wilson Good." I said, "This is Michael Africa." He said, "I'm glad you called." Then we had a few meetings. And then we connected. He wrote support letters for the release of my family. And then we connected with other politicians, city council members, and District Attorney Larry Krasner, who at the time was calling him, they were calling him the progressive DA. And we put all of those pieces together. On June 16th, 2018, after 40 years in prison, I went and picked up my mother, brought her home. When my mom came home, the FOP president, the Fraternal Order of Police president, he saw my mother on the news, and they did a press conference with him, and he said, "One slipped through the cracks. This Michael Davis, this next person up, we'll be waiting on him. We'll make sure that he is denied parole." They asked, "How long do you want him to stay in prison? He's been in prison for 40 years. He said, "I want him to do the full term." A full term is 100 years. He's not going to live that long. If he dies before the 100 years, we want his body to occupy a cell until the 100 years is up. So we rallied. We got more people involved, more support. I went to 6 different continents getting support from presidents of this country, and I went all around this world to get support because I knew whatever I needed had to be somewhere in this haystack, right? 4 months later, I went to the prison and I picked up my dad too. Right. My parents came home. I said, "Mom, I said, look, you've been home, you home for a little while." I said, I ain't got a lot of money, but you know, I wish I could give you everything, but like, tell me one thing, one big thing that you wish you had. You say one thing, I'll make sure I get it for you. I ain't got a lot of money, but I get it. What you want? She said, "Baby, I'm just happy to be home with you." I said, "Okay." My dad, when he came home, I said, "Dad, same thing. If there's anything you say you want, I ain't got a lot of money, but I'll make sure it happens. What you want?" He said, "Mike, I only want one thing." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I want to marry your mother like I should have done 40 years ago." So we called his family. He said, "Oh," and then he said, "And I don't want to wait. I'm not waiting." I said, "All right." So 2 months later, he had to wait. 2 months later, 200 of their closest family and friends came to the church to watch them get married. And then one by one, all of the MOVE 9, all the prisoners, came home from prison. The last person to come home was my Uncle Chuck. He spent 42 years in prison. Delbert, who was beaten by the cops, he came home just before Chuck after spending nearly 42 years himself. Mumia Abu-Jamal is the last person in that MOVE considers family. He's still in prison. He's got one of those cases where he was there on the scene, a police officer was shot and killed, and because he is this lieutenant of information for the Black Panther Party and supporter of the MOVE organization and a journalist, you know how they treat journalists that talk about issues, that speak the truth about things? There were many people on the scene, But because he was on the scene, he was taken to jail. And he's been in jail since 1981. So we're trying to work to free him. My work never ends. I'm always trying to do something to talk about what happened, but I don't know. There's this kind of thing in me that feel like I gotta kind of like put the pieces, collect as many pieces of my family history, as my family as I can, and try to put them back together. The house that was bombed on Osage Avenue, that was my aunt's house. She lived long enough to watch everybody come home from prison. After all those years, even though we were estranged, she never stopped supporting their freedom. So I'm talking to her, and you know, she cursed me out for like 8 hours. And once she stopped cursing me out, she asked me how I was doing and all this kind of stuff. I went to see her. We sat down on our couch, and I was talking to her, and then she cursed me out for another like 8 hours face to face. But during that time, I asked her same thing, like, what do you want? Like, if there's something that I can do. She's 86 years old. I'm like, you know. And she says, yeah. She said, I want my house back. I'm like, what house? Osage Avenue. And I was immediately angry. Why? So much death and destruction. The spirits there, like, why? I would, you know, and she, now I'm asking you if there's something I can do for you, right? Like, I asked my parents if something I can do for them because it's something I want to do for them. When I'm asking you what, she says, I'm gonna get my house back. And I'm, but why do you want it back? I said, these are my words to her, with so much death and destruction in that house, why do you want it back? She gave me the simplest answer. She said, because it's mine.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And they took it from
me. She said, it belonged in my family, not the city's. She said, I bought that house with my money, and it belongs in my family. That's why I want it back. So I went to the city and I said, look, you did all of this stuff to us. I want our house back. And this is the perfect time to give it back because the redevelopment department for the city of Philadelphia has come and they bought the house from the city for a dollar and they're going to sell it to a developer to rehab it. So here's the number to the solicitor that can help you with that. Okay, good. So I call the solicitor. Hey, this is Michael Davis. I give you my alias. I don't tell him my real name. This is where I cash my checks in, my driver's license. This is Michael Davis. Can I talk to you about the house? Yeah, the house being sold to the developer. Okay, no. I want to buy it. You know, how much is it being sold for? Being sold for a dollar. I got a dollar? No, wait. Let me talk to the developer. So he's looking it up and everything. And he says, what's your name? I said, my name is Michael Davis. And he stops and he said, He said, no, we can't sell the house to you. I said, why not? He said, because your name is Africa. Yeah. So they sold it to the developer. A few years passed and they rehabbed it. They sold it to a private resident. And on May 13th, the anniversary, every year we do a commemoration at the site. But this day we were on the parkway a block away and I got a phone call. This guy says, hey, you Mike Africa? I say, yeah. Like, how'd you get my number? He's like, well, you know, I know a guy that knows a guy. Anyway, do you want to buy this house? What house? I live at 6221 Osage Avenue, the house that was bombed. Hell yeah. I said, why are you selling it? He says, because I can't use my front door without a camera in my face. People come from all over. They always want to see the house, and they always knocking on the door. So it don't belong to us. It belongs to y'all. But I can't give it to you because I paid for it. And gentrification kicked in. This is a row house. It's the first floor is not as big as this floor. Like it's a row house. You know what I'm saying? But they still want $400,000. So I said, look, I still want it. I ain't got no $400,000. I ain't got nowhere near that. I got like $20 in the bank, but we'll figure out how to work it out. So I went to my friends and some family members, and we put up enough money for a down payment. So on January 10th, 2023, we did put a down payment on to buy it back. So that's what we're working on now. Yes, 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 yes. My family is a very controversial family. I don't agree or like everything about it, but, you know, they stood for something that's important that a lot of people are still fighting today. And so I really respect them for that, and I appreciate them for that. And I'm just trying to, like, you know, I guess walk in the footsteps of this positivity that they lived. So thank you all for listening to me. Yes, yes.